Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, it's Joe, and welcome to another episode of Test Talks. In today's show, we'll be test talking with Andy Tinkham, a software testing expert with over 20 years of experience, about his views on modern testing. Andy goes over how testing has evolved and what we as testers need to know, as well as how we are all responsible for helping to shape the future of testing. Within Andy's philosophy of modern testing, there are four main principles that he shares with us, broken down into four pillars. Context first, testers are not robots, uses for multiple lenses for test design, and providing useful and timely information. So if you're a tester and you want to continue being a tester in the 21st century, you want to listen up. Check it out. Test Talks is sponsored by the fantastic folks at Sauce Labs, the cloud-based automated testing platform that eliminates the need to maintain your own Selenium grid and test infrastructure. Try it for free today. Visit testtalks.com and click on the Sign Up Now link under the homepage sponsor section. Hey, Andy. Welcome back to Test Talks.
Thanks, Joe. I'm excited to be here.
It's great to have you back on the show. Last time we spoke was in episode 78. So I think you've changed jobs since then. So what have you been up to? What's new?
Well, I am the practice lead for a company called C2 Solutions. We're a Twin Cities-based consultancy. Our biggest practice is a QA and testing practice. And as practice lead, I am at the head of that. I get involved in everything we do, whether that's some billing work or supporting my other consultants in their delivery efforts, sales and recruiting, internally building a community, and externally growing C2's reputation.
Awesome. So today I'd like to talk about your presentation called Modern Testing. And so I guess first thing, what do you mean by modern testing? Has testing really changed in the past few years? What are your thoughts on that?
I think absolutely testing is changing, and we haven't seen the full extent of that change yet. The rise of agile methodology, the headlines we see about big tech companies getting rid of their testers, you know, the scary, oh no, am I going to have a job type articles, where companies aren't actually getting rid of testing. They're getting rid of people who had a particular job title of tester. But all of these pieces are driving a big piece of change. We've got more sophisticated users who have more things competing for their attention. We've got app stores that make it easier for users to switch if we're in some sort of commercial application space. We've got shorter and shorter development cycles. I would say, based on my consulting experience, Agile is so far established that if we think about Jeffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm Gap, we're down to the laggards. Most places have adopted something that they call Agile, which may or may not look anything like what other people call Agile, but they have something in place. And a common feature is this faster release cycle. And the old ways that we've approached testing don't scale as well or at all in those environments. We're also building more complex systems. We've solved the easy problems in software. We're trying different things. We're reaching further. We're building bigger systems with more interconnections and more integrations and more functionality. And so we need another pressure there to scale our testing. At the same time, we've got developers and other team members taking a bigger ownership role in quality, which is great. It's wonderful to see this happening, but it means that some of the tasks that have been traditionally the purview of the QA group, the testing group, are now being claimed by others. And so how do we adapt to that when we're finally getting this thing we've asked for developers to be more aware of quality and not just throwing something over the wall with a basic, yep, it compiles, if we even get that. And finally, we've got more sophisticated automation coming through as well, which, again, is cutting into some of the tasks that have traditionally been assigned to testers. I would say that the rate of change is indicating to me that within 5 or 10 years, the traditional role of tester, the traditional QA organization, is at a minimum going to look extremely different, if it even exists still. I think we're at a crossroads, and we really need to respond to it as an industry.
I definitely agree. Almost everyone I speak to now, they're having the same issues. And I don't know if it's a misunderstanding of what a QA tester role is or what a QA tester, someone with those skills, does, but I've been hearing this for the past few years, QA is dead, testing is dead, but I really don't see that. I see people with those skills just doing more stuff, but like you said, not necessarily having the title of a manual QA tester or something. How do you think that's going to impact us in 5 to 10 years? I've also heard that, you know, eventually we're not going to be developing because it's going to be so sophisticated that people will just be able to generate code. So I know that's not going to happen, but it's this kind of story we hear over and over again that you're going to be replaced. You're going to be replaced.
I think there are kind of two questions there. So the first piece, the QA is dead, the testing is dead piece. My take on that is that is an extent of a sensationalization of the same thing that I'm talking about. The testing activity isn't going away, but there are people that I've met in the course of my career who are very mechanically focused in the way that they approach their job. There's a very, I wouldn't say mentality, but an external perception that the role is insert one requirement, get one test case out over and over and over, and you just turn the crank and you get a set of test cases based on the requirement. There are test organizations who either are not providing enough value to their organization, they may be seen as a roadblock, they may be doing the wrong things, or they may simply not be communicating the value they're providing, and the value is largely unseen. And I think that more and more, those are just going to be cut, those roles, those positions, those departments, because businesses are going to say, why am I paying for this? Because they're not seeing that value. As an industry, we're a good chunk of the blame, or we share a good chunk of the blame for that. There are things that we've done that have made us that kind of roadblock, that kind of somebody to be worked around rather than a team member. We've taken the concept of repeatability and put it up on a pedestal. We've said repeatability is everything. Everything must be repeatable. Anybody must be able to run this. And by doing that, we've cut out the individual differences we bring. We've cut out the fact that testing is a skilled and knowledgeable profession. We've said, you know, when we say anybody, people hear anybody. Even if we mean any tester with a sufficient level of skill and knowledge, that's not what people are hearing. So now they're hearing, well, anybody can do this. You hear the old, well, I can just go get 5 people off the street to come in and test this. Why do I need you type piece? And we've done that to ourselves. We've also pushed back as organizations have tried to change to become more effective. I've seen test groups that are extremely dogmatic in their process adherence, where this is the one process we agreed on and we must do it this way. And it doesn't matter that it doesn't make sense right now. This is the process. We've got to do it. And it's no wonder when faced with that kind of attitude that an organization would try to work around that, because they're trying to get better. They're trying to be more efficient. And then the testers are working as a roadblock there. We spend a lot of time operating under a shallow agreement. Quality is a very vague and nebulous term. It is not the same each person. It's very subjective, but we all just act as if we know what quality is. One of my roles at C2 is interviewing potential candidates who might join my practice and be placed at our clients. And I love to ask them what quality is, because I never get the same answer. You know, there might be some variant on conformance to requirements or suitable for purpose, you know, the classic Duran and Deming type answers, but nobody phrases it the same way. Even if they're getting at those concepts, unless they use those specific words that Duran and Deming used. And most of people haven't ever been asked that question, or they've never had to articulate what quality is. It's just one of those things that, well, we know it when we see it. But if you think about a project manager, things that they're going to value as quality are things like on time, under budget, nobody yells at us for it. Whereas what a salesperson might value are features that easily demo, features that stand up well against our competition, and that they're not necessarily conflicting definitions of quality, but they're not necessarily the same definition of quality either. And we just talk about this quality thing as if we all mean the same thing by it. And that sometimes hurts us. We also, as an industry, again, we've become like that apocryphal scientific study about the scientists who put the monkeys in the cage and, put some bananas at the top of a ladder, and anytime the monkeys tried to climb the ladder, they sprayed them with a fire hose, And so the monkeys stopped wanting the bananas, but then they started swapping out the monkeys one at a time. And anytime a new monkey went for the bananas, the other ones would gang up on them and beat them up. And eventually they got to the point where there were none of the original monkeys, and none of them had ever been sprayed, but they all continued to beat up new monkeys who went for the bananas. That's not apparently actually a real study. I went looking and Snopes says it's fake. But the idea there illustrates what I'm talking about. There are things that we as an industry have just said, this is good testing. We must do it this way, even though we don't necessarily know what value it provides. And it's just, nope, we have to do this. At the same time, when we're doing that, we're getting in the way of the process. We're downplaying our skills. If I had a nickel for every time I heard someone say, well, I'm just a tester, I can't do that. Or, you know, something else that downplayed the knowledge and skill we bring to the team, the value of the actions we do, I might not be able to retire, but I wouldn't be hurting for cash. It's a common thing. We as an industry have internalized some of this lower class citizenship that we've had to deal with for decades. And then we reinforce it with our actions. We reinforce it by not pushing back when we should, when there are clear cases where we can add value. We've commoditized our skills. I see this particularly from a consulting standpoint, but there are a lot of clients for whom the determining factor with the person that they'll bring in as a consultant is who's cheapest, who can get me a body in a chair for as fast or for as little price as I can. And when we have that kind of commoditization race, everybody loses. We all end up making minimum wage for this skilled and knowledgeable profession because it's just, well, you know, I can shave another dollar off that rate. And it's just like the automated systems that set prices on Amazon, where all of a sudden you find this book that's several sellers are selling for $10, and then there's two that are selling it for $5,000 because they've used the same algorithm of go one penny higher than the previous highest one. And they just bounce off each other and rack the price up. And those vendors are never going to sell those books because everybody else is like, selling this for $10. We've done that kind of commoditization. We've focused ourselves on again, with that repeatability, we focused ourselves on dehumanizing work. When we give somebody a stack of scripts with every action spelled out in detail, and we work through some sort of evaluation, whether it's an official evaluation or more just a aren't you done yet type evaluation, that encourages them to stick to those scripts, that evaluates them by the number of those scripts they can get through in a period of time, we're taking the humanity out of the job. We've both said explicitly what to do, and we've put an evaluation system in place that guarantees that people stay on the script. We can have robots do that. But for a lot of testers that I've seen over the years, that is the extent of what they do. And maybe there's some thinking at the beginning, but then after that, because of that enshrining of repeatability, it's here you go. Here's today's programming. Go execute it.
I definitely agree. And I particularly see this more often, I think, than more people. Maybe not. I just think I'm in a business where it's heavily regulated by the FDA. And so what happens is people say we need objective evidence, and they throw that around, meaning we need a script and we can't deviate from the script and we need to follow it step by step and then record every single expected and actual output. And that's what we do. And they get so fed up that they think, well, we'll just automate all of it because obviously it needs to be objective evidence. And the only way to get that is to record it and have it a log file and script it and be done with it. And I think that really, like you says, it kind of takes away the true value of what a thinking person can do to actually find real issues with your application.
Yep, absolutely.
So I think you have a few areas that you talk about within your presentation to kind of get us over this type of thinking. And
right.
So I think the first one is context first. What is context first?
Well, let me back up for 1 second, because there's one more piece I want to cover before we get into the pillars of modern testing.
Sure.
This is a philosophy. This is not a methodology. It's not the new version of good testing. This is a way of thinking about what good testing is. It is probably still going to evolve, and it is entirely built on the work of a bunch of smart people who've influenced me over the years. And this is kind of my synthesis of their work, my own combining and fleshing things out. A few months ago, I was out in Washington State. James Bach and his brother John did a Reinventing Testers workshop. And I don't want to go into a lot about the workshop right now, but Rob Saborin was there too. Rob's a university professor at McGill, does a lot of stuff in the testing community, really great guy. And early on in that workshop, we were talking about what is a reinvented tester. And the definition that Rob came up with matches very much what I think a modern tester is. So a modern tester is one who understands the essence of testing. It's moving beyond the some guru says I should do this, so this is what I should do. It's not just, well, I know I should do regression testing. It's really understanding the essence there. What are we trying to accomplish? What are we doing? Why is this thing something we could even consider doing? And then knows how to apply their skills as their context changes around them. What our team is trying to achieve and what it needs to do that is changing, recognizing that that change is constant, and really applying those skills, applying that knowledge of the essence. So within the philosophy, there are a set of principles that we'll get to later because I've distilled them down into four pillars. And the four pillars are context first, as you mentioned. Testers are not robots. Using multiple lenses for test design and providing usable and timely information. And so you asked about context first. But context, much like the context-driven testing school that we talked about last time, much as they emphasize all of these pieces that define the project, the people involved in it, the user population that we're developing for, the processes that are in place, missions of the test group, are we trying to check an app prior to submitting it to an app store? And so we're just working through the stated guidelines to make sure there's no obvious failures that they're going to bounce us right away. Or are we working in that kind of regulated environment where if we miss something, people could die? The mission of the test group is very much going to inform what we do. The business objectives of the organization are also going to. Are we trying to get a product out first? Are we trying to present ourselves as the most reliable option? Again, these are going to impact what good testing is. We're also going to be affected by the specifications we have available, requirements, use stories, back of the napkin scrawlings, random hallway conversations that are the only time a feature is ever discussed. All of these sorts of specs, again, change what we can do and affect what good testing is on the project. The resources we have available. Do we have a test lab? Is it shared? Does that matter? That, again, is going to affect us, as well as all the deadlines that are in place. If we have a deadline of a week from now, we can't do as much testing, probably, if we have a deadline of 2 months from now. So all of these things combine together to make up context. And traditionally, what I've seen is a tester has an understanding in their head of what good testing is. They come into a context, or their context on their team changes, or at some point, and they're trying to jam their idea of good testing into that context. And sometimes it works well, and other times it doesn't. But the definition of good testing came first in that. And in modern testing, which is what I call this philosophy that I'm promoting, the understanding of the context comes first, and then that defines what good testing is in that context at that moment in time.
Awesome. Once again, I definitely agree with this, and I think this kind of is one of the problems I've been facing is we've moved from waterfall to agile, and so the context now has changed, yet they're still trying to do, a lot of people are still trying to do the waterfall processes that doesn't fit in now with the context that we're working in. And so there's a constant conflict now. Rather than saying, look, I know what good testing is, let me apply it now to this new context and help drive that process, rather than becoming a roadblock and trying to jam something down that no longer fits. Is that your main point?
That's the first pillar, yeah.
Awesome.
There are other pieces around that too. It is the get the understanding, use that to define what good testing is, but it's also avoiding best practice thinking. This is a piece that comes directly from the context-driven stuff.
Yep.
The term best practice, we may have talked about this actually last time I was on 78, but the term best practice is a limiting term. It shuts down thinking about whether a practice applies in a given context. It already has the term best in it. What is better than best? There is nothing. Best is the superlative. So it's got that hidden cue built right in that, well, if it's a best practice, it must be something we should be doing. And that's not necessarily true. There are certainly good practices in context. There's certainly, I would even go so far as to say, for a particular team, in a particular time, in a particular context, there is a best practice potentially for them. But it is not an industry-wide best practice. It is not necessarily even a constant practice. It is the thing that the team gets the most value out of doing at that moment. And so maintaining that objectivity, that ability to look at it and say, that's an interesting idea. And I see that it worked over here and over there, but that's not like my situation. And that practice might be good for me. It might not. And recognizing that distinction and not just saying, yep, must be good, going to do it. There's also the idea, we talked about the shallow agreement, that we mean different things. That's part of the context as well. Making sure that we're all working towards the same missions and objectives, the same definition of what a quality product is. So that really is that whole first pillar.
Okay, so the second pillar then is testers are not robots. I think you touched a little bit on this already, but what's your definition of we're not robots?
This is a broad answer here. There are multiple pieces. The first piece is recognizing that an individual tester brings skills, they bring knowledge, they bring experience. And the way that you test a feature and the way that I test a feature might not be the same. And that can be really good because I might find bugs you'll miss and vice versa. It also recognizes that if we're doing all that test design up front and then just keeping the scripts and passing them off to a robot, whether it's a human or a computer, when we design those scripts, we are at the point when we know the least about the functionality we're testing that we're going to know in the entire test cycle. We're going to learn more as we work through it, as we see how it actually works, as we come up with more experiments to try. And recognizing that because we're human, we're doing this and building pieces into the process, whether it's through a session-based exploratory testing model or using automation in combination with manual testers, gives us a much better ability to capitalize on those skills that testers bring. Another piece that I think has come out of this a little bit, and I'm a little hesitant to say this on a show that largely focuses on automation, but I think we've enshrined automation too far. And that's where we get the automate everything type of discussions, where teams of people are often figuring out how to change how they work to make it easier for automation. Whether that's our automation engineers don't know the system well enough, so they have to have the precise steps, or we're going to have to tell the computer at some point the precise steps, so let's do them now, or let's completely change how we store this data so that we can easily suck it in through programming code. And there's a place for that. There absolutely is a place for that. And having started as an automator myself, having that enshrining of automation has benefited my career, absolutely. But I think that when it comes at the cost of downplaying that human element, it costs us something. And I'm no longer convinced that having automation always be the penultimate thing, the best testing we're trying to get to all automation, is the right way to go. Absolutely, we need automation. But we need to use it smartly. We need to use it in combination with human efforts in order to support what is ultimately a human activity.
Yeah, so I'm all about automation. I don't think most people, most companies can succeed without it. And that's not what you're saying. You're not saying no automation whatsoever. It's the context you're in and what makes sense for your team. So I definitely agree with that. And I like the point you brought up that two testers won't necessarily find the same bug. So they may go about testing differently. And so therefore, they'll uncover different bugs than one another. And I think what happens is when you do follow a set script or have just an automated script that does everything and you rely on that, you get into unintentional blindness where you're so focused on a certain piece of functionality that you overlook other bugs that may be happening around you because you're so zoned in on this one little area. So I definitely agree that that's actually a danger almost, especially if you're doing medical applications or things like that. So even if you had everything automated and you could automate everything, you'd be in trouble because you're not looking at other scenarios that you're not focusing on.
Right. Computers are really bad at noticing the unexpected because we didn't know to tell them to look for it. It's unexpected. People are really good at that much of the time. And while it is very contextual where the line is, there is, for most projects, a combination of manual testing and automation that make the most sense to achieve the goal. Now, I have seen teams where they are so focused on the stuff that could be automated that they never do the other things. And that, I think, ties back again to that testing is dead mentality, where it quickly becomes like just a question of, I can invest how much now to create automation for that, or keep paying six people's salaries or however many for how long to keep running these by hand. And that becomes a financial trade-off and not one of value at that point.
I think we also touched on this next point last time, but once again, what is the multiple lens view that you talk about?
For me, a lens is a metaphor for a mental model. We have a number of models we can create of the system we're working on. Requirements or user stories or whatever our specifications are give us one perspective on that system. They give us one mental model. And if we really think about how analysts are doing their work, how developers are doing their work, they're thinking about how the system should function. And they may break off and think some about error conditions or what should happen when something goes wrong. But for the most part, the specifications are, this is what it should look like when it works. And so that gives us a mental model that's biased towards, this is the way the system should work. And that's an important model. We absolutely need to have that model. We need to test against it. We need to make sure that the system works as it's intended to work. But the bias that that gives us in the test cases gives us an incomplete view of the landscape of possible tests. And just like if we were looking through a telescope versus a handheld magnifying glass, some things would be emphasized differently between the two lenses, and some things would be obscured differently between the two lenses. Different lenses, different mental models give us different sets of tests. So another lens we might use would be one of risk, and not risk at a, there's a chance that, living in Minnesota, fishing season is a big thing here. It's not a risk that there's a chance that all six team members are going to get sick magically on the first day of fishing season, or that level of project risk. This is a deep functional risk. So for this feature that I'm testing, how can I imagine that it might go astray, that it might go wrong, that it might do the wrong thing? And then how would I know if that was the case? And how can I turn that into a test case? Now that's going to give us a different set of tests than one where we work through the requirements. And that the risk focus set is also going to be biased. It's going to be biased much more to the edge case, what happens when we get off in the weeds type test. And we can look at the system from another perspective. We could look at it from a security perspective, for example. We could say, where is there data that a hacker might be interested in obtaining? Or where are there weak points in the communication between our components that somebody could tap into and observe what's going on? We could look at it from a performance lens. Where are our potential bottlenecks? What could I do that might lead to the system choking? One project I worked on was for syringe pumps for hospitals. The sort of pump where you put a syringe in, hook it up to an IV, and over time, the pump very slowly pushes that plunger down on the syringe to give a very slow and constant application of whatever's in the syringe. And these syringe pumps were connected to Wi-Fi. They'd sync back every 10 seconds or something like that. And just, here's how much should be left in the syringe and standard operating data. One of the things that we found when we were looking at it from a performance standpoint was what would happen to the back end systems if the hospital Wi-Fi went down. Networks being what they are, sometimes they go down. What if we were down for a week and all of these pumps, which had been accumulating updates to send every 10 seconds for a week, decided that when that Wi-Fi came back up, that they were all just going to send that data back to the back end, because that would be really bad to have that crash the back end. And we also wanted to know how long it would take for the back end to catch up. That's a test that we wouldn't have come up with if we just used the requirements lens. We had to look at the performance and how the data flowed through the system, and were there places we could get a bottleneck to think of that. So moving beyond just using requirements, which is a place where I see many testers just stop. They're very much that, again, that mechanical, I put a requirement in, I get a test case out. I'll work through all that. When I've tested all the requirements, I'm done. I would say a huge percentage of the potential candidates I talk to describe that as testing. And modern testing needs to move beyond that. We need to move beyond those tests, which if we're focusing on the same aspects that the whole team has thought about all along anyhow, are probably the least likely tests to find bugs, which doesn't mean we still shouldn't run them. They're important tests. But we need to think about the other areas where bugs could be and bring that in, because that's a place where we can add huge, huge value to the team.
Awesome. I love this pillar. For some reason, every time you talk about it, I think of Einstein and a thought experiment. And that's what it almost sounds like. You're thinking of things kind of outside the box or coming at it from a different angle. And that's where a lot of times you find really interesting cases like you brought up.
I can't imagine doing tests without this now. It is so much the chance to be creative, to think through all sorts of different aspects. And there are several places you can find lists of various quality attributes. Wikipedia has a list. Rickard Edgren and some colleagues somewhere in Europe, I should know where they are. I want to say Sweden, but I'm not positive there. But to the test side, they've got a two-page PDF with all sorts of various attributes that could be lenses. Even Elizabeth Hendrickson's test heuristics cheat sheet, particularly the heuristics piece. There's things like Goldilocks and CRUD. All of these things give you different models on the system. And that's the fun part.
Very cool. All right, the last pillar is usable and timely info.
That comes back to the fact that testing is, at its heart, an information-providing activity. Most testers I know aren't going into the code base and fixing the bugs they find. They're not designing the application up front, although they might be in some of those meetings. They might certainly be reviewing the results of those meetings as well. But at its heart, as a test team, we are providing information back to our stakeholders, back to our team, to inform them of what we know about the quality of the system so that they can make decisions like, is it time to ship? Or are we at a good enough level where we can start talking about things? Or, you know, whatever information they need. And that's going to be very contextual as well, tying us back to the context first pillar. But what we've traditionally done in our reporting is we've given our team, we've given our stakeholders raw data, give them counts. We say, for this feature, I had 72 test cases, and I ran 65 of them, and 60 passed. But there are so many interpretations of that data. First, why do we have 72 test cases? Maybe we should have had 75, and we just didn't have time to write three of them. Maybe we should have had 200, and we haven't had time to write a lot of them. Or maybe we only needed 60 in the first place, and so we have extra test cases. And once we get past that, well, then why did we only run 65 of them? What about the other seven? Were they not important? Were they the most important tests? And so all we know is that cosmetically the feature looks good because we have 65 tests written for that. But the seven tests that actually do the functionality, the thing, the reason that exists, haven't been run yet. Are the seven tests just broken and we don't care about them? They don't matter? That there's so much there. And then, okay, only 60 passed. Well, were they the 60 least important, the 60 most important? We could be in really good shape through those numbers, or we could be in really bad shape. And we don't provide the interpretation of the data. We just say, here is the raw data. Sometimes put it in a table. The worst cases I've seen are just, here's every metric I can think of to calculate or grab out of my test case management system or whatever. And here's a bunch of numbers. And that does a huge disservice to our teams. It decreases the value we provide because the value is inherently in that information. And it means that if we're making our recipients do all that interpretation work, we again undermined ourselves with that, well, anybody can do this. How hard is it to go look in the test case system and say, okay, there are 72 records in this list? So in modern testing, part of understanding the context first is understanding what the information needs of the team and stakeholders are. And it's not generally going to be how many test cases do we have, although they might frame it that way because many managers have been trained over their careers that that's how you get information about quality. But when it comes down to it, most managers probably don't care a lot about the number of test cases. They just use that as a surrogate measure for more test cases equals more testing. And what they really are concerned about is things like, if we release now, how many phone calls are my support center techs going to get? Or how bad are the headlines going to be if we have a problem? Or how much is this going to impact my bonus? And other pieces of quality than just the metrics. So what we need to do, first of all, is provide more context around our data. Michael Bolton talks about having three stories that we provide when we're providing information. First, we're talking about the quality of the application itself. What have we seen work? What have we seen not work? And what can we extrapolate from what we've done to include other situations where it might or might not? But that's not enough in and of itself. If I'm your tester and you're a stakeholder, and I say the product is good, that's all I tell you. You have nothing to evaluate that on other than to what degree do you trust me? So the second story that comes in is, what did I do to get that story of the quality? If all I say, if I say the product is good, I logged in and I got to my homepage, that's not a very thorough definition of good in most situations. That's probably pretty weak testing in nearly every context. Unless you're making a login dialog widget or something, maybe. But if I tell you that I went through, I looked through a requirements lens, I looked through a risk lens, I looked through a security lens, I went through a performance lens, I picked the highest value test cases from all of those lenses, I thoroughly executed the top priority test cases, and everything came out the way I expected it to, that's a deeper level. So now you've got more ability to evaluate my first statement, well, the product is good, because you have that information about what I did. But that's still not enough, because most of the people we're communicating to aren't testers. They don't have a testing background. They don't have the ability to say, was that the right amount of testing in this case? And so that's where the third story comes in, which is the story of the quality of the testing. And that's where we start talking about things like, how much have I covered? Why did I do what I did? Why is this enough testing or not enough testing? What's needed to get more information? What got in my way as I was trying to get through things? Are there places where I couldn't get to evaluate? And so altogether, these three things, you've got the evaluation of the product, you've got the ability to evaluate how much trust to put in that based on what I've done, and you've got the ability to evaluate what I've done based on the reasoning and the what else would it take to get more information, gives a much clearer picture. So that's one piece of the usable and timely information. The other piece of the usable side is using tools from data science, things like graphs, ways of presenting the data that aren't just, here's a raw number, or even a set of raw numbers, and go interpret them as you wish. That there are ways to better convey the message we're trying to convey with those numbers. And so when people ask me, actually, I just had a LinkedIn message this morning. Someone asked me about my thoughts on, do testers have to code? And there are career paths for testers where absolutely testers have to code. If you're going into automation, that's development. You would be very well served to know how to code in that if you're in an automation path. There are career paths where it could be helpful, but there might be a chance that you end up thinking too similarly to the developers and you all miss a bug. But certainly it gives you a better awareness of how programs work, of how computers function, and that can be very helpful in designing test cases. But then there are also paths where I don't think you need to know how to code at all. And data science is one piece of that. I think that as we focus on this information providing piece of modern testing, there's more and more room for people who know how to present data, who know how to analyze it for patterns, who need to mine the deep insights from the data that we're not as a team getting right now. And I think that's another path that's open to testers, and it doesn't require coding at all. So that's the usable side. And then the last bit of it is timely. it doesn't do anybody any good if you sit on the information for 3 weeks to try to get to the end of the test cycle. There are pieces of information that the team needs right now, and there are pieces of information that giving the team right now would be too soon. They wouldn't be able to use it. The information will go stale before it's needed. And recognizing the combination, recognizing what are the actual information needs my team and stakeholders have now, and how can I address those, and adapting as those needs change is the final piece of that.
Okay, Andy, before we go, what's the best way that someone could find or contact you?
Probably through, you can either do it via email. Email gets my attention pretty quickly most days. Andy at C2ITS, like Cornerstone to Information Technology Systems is what the acronym stands for. So C2ITS.com. On Twitter, where I'm Andy Tinkham, T-I-N-K-H-A-M is my last name. And on various podcasts around the world, and maybe someday on my own again.
Thank you, Andy, for your modern testing awesomeness. For links to everything of value that we covered in this episode, head on over to testtalks.com/116. And while you're there, make sure to click on the Sign Up Now free button under the exclusive sponsor section to learn all about Sauce Labs' awesome products and services. And if this episode has helped you in any way, why not share it with a friend or coworker by sending them over to testtalks.com or sending them the links to the free Test Talks app for both Android and iOS devices. And if you're also awesome, if you haven't already, why not rate and review Test Talks on iTunes? Ratings and reviews really help in the ranking of the show, and I appreciate everyone's feedback. So that's it for this episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with automation awesomeness. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.